Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Yasmin Khan, a reporter here at KUNM. The New Mexico legislature is in full swing, discussing bills that will shape everything from education to transportation. Today, we'll take a look at two bills that could have far-reaching consequences in our state, including for communities of color. House Bill 70, which revises the definitions of domestic terrorism in New Mexico, and House Bill 40, which aims to end private prison contracts in our state. Both bills echo national movements to address domestic terrorism after the January 6th Capitol attacks and President Biden's January 26th executive order to end Justice Department contracts with private prisons. And we want to hear from you. Do you think our state needs new domestic terrorism legislation? Have you or a loved one been impacted by the private prison system? Join the conversation by emailing letstalk@kunm.org or call into the show at 277-5866. We will talk about both bills today, starting with the domestic terrorism definitions bill and then moving on to the private prison contract bill. And I want to welcome Representative Diane Hochman-Vigil, co-sponsor of House Bill 70. And also joining us today is Peter Simonson, executive director of the ACLU in New Mexico. Welcome, Representative, and welcome, Peter.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
Representative Hochman-Vigil, House Bill 70 is a revision of current anti-terrorism legislation that was enacted in 1990. How is this bill changing that current legislation, and why does it need to be updated?
Thanks, Yasmin. So appreciate you having me here today to talk about these two important bills. The domestic terrorism bill actually came about after a summit that was held by the governor's office back in 2019, pre-pandemic world, in response to the mass shooting in El Paso. So what this bill aims to do is to modernize and to help narrow the scope of our domestic terrorism laws so that we can make sure prosecutors can utilize it in special instances where they feel the facts match this crime of domestic terrorism, and it also allows the opportunity to prosecute for internet-based crimes as well. The last thing that this bill does is it creates what we're calling the New Mexico All-Source Intelligence Center, which is a cross-jurisdictional partnership between Homeland Security and other local state agencies to kind of help hone the prosecutorial process for domestic terrorism in New Mexico.
And so this bill, is it a consequence of the January 6th Capitol riots?
The way back in 1990, you mean?
No, this new bill.
Oh, the January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. So what's interesting about that is this bill, actually, we ran it last year in the January 2020 session, got really close to passing it, and we ran out of time to try and get on the agenda in the last committee we were in the Senate. And after the events of January 6th, we got kind of thrust into the spotlight again with the events of what happened, kind of just underscoring the fact that, you know, these laws and these particular definitions are necessary because there are certain facts that make these crimes different from others. So I guess the answer to your question is both yes and no.
Okay. And Peter, where does the ACLU stand with this bill?
Well, we've had concerns about legislation like this, both at the state and federal level, for quite a long time. You know, the state has, in fact, updated its laws to try and address both terrorist acts and computer-related crimes over the last several years. We have an anti-terrorism act that this vastly expands. I'd take slight issue, the slight disagreement with the representative's characterization of this actually narrowing the law. It actually vastly expands the law and creates new penalties and ups the existing penalties for anything that could be construed as a terrorist act. And then also turns the Computer Crimes Act, which was passed several years ago, that identifies various kinds of attempts to thwart proper use of online communications, creates new terrorist enhancements for violations of that act. So, you know, part of our concern is that the government already has these tools at its disposal, that is to say, it already has crimes available to it that it can charge people who are committing criminal activity that has some sort of terroristic impact or intent. And, you know, we haven't seen any instances in history, and certainly not in recent history, where our prosecutors, our law enforcement system hasn't had the laws necessary to respond to crimes that could be construed as terrorism. And, you know, I think we just have to keep in mind that, you know, we have a long history, and particularly a recent history, of laws like this being used disproportionately against disenfranchised communities, communities of color. It's not so long ago that we were faced with a glut of legislative proposals just like this, but the concern was around foreign terrorism, and people in our country identified strictly on the basis of their religious and racial ethnic identity. And being targeted by these kinds of laws. You know, we had in the days after September 11th, Middle Eastern young men being swept up and unfairly incarcerated, detained on the basis of using a material support statute that was created ostensibly to protect against domestic terrorism, but was really used to basically neutralize and incarcerate people who had no relationship to terrorism. So, yeah, we can get into that more, but I think those are some of our key concerns. And I just add that, you know, the definition that's now created for terrorism under this law is pretty broad. It can be used in a variety of circumstances where legitimate First Amendment activity is implicated. We can get into some more details about that.
And I just want to clarify exactly, how does this bill expand the current bill? Representative, can you just explain? I know there were two specific parts that you explained to me the other day.
So we're going to get to the definitional part of the law. And also, I would like to kind of respond to Director Simonson. So I'm a little confused by the ACLU's position now, because we actually consulted with them in great detail last year in hopes of coming to consensus with the definition. And I know that they did have, we had quite a few conversations and sit downs, and this law is exactly the same law that we amended and brought last year. So I'm a little taken aback by the ACLU's position on this, but it is important to me to actually get this definition right. My first job before I went to law school was with the ACLU. And so I think it's really important that we get the definition in this particular law correct so that we don't infringe upon First Amendment rights. But I would also disagree that this law is not necessary, because domestic terrorism and the acts that lead up to it really do set others apart, other crimes apart, because of the intent requirements. And while many criminal laws can be used against disenfranchised communities, I would say that this law is actually less of a risk because of the particular intent that it requires to prove, whereas other more generalized categories can and have been used against disenfranchised communities. I'm still looking to find the definition here.
So I think it would be useful to understand what is the difference between being charged with terrorism and being charged with, say, a hate crime? And what does it mean? What can happen to a person if they're charged with terrorism? I don't know if, Peter, if you want to take this one.
So I have the definition here if you want to go to me or if you want to go to Peter first.
Oh, okay. Whatever. Go ahead, Representative, with the definition.
So with this law, the definition is terrorism consists of committing any act that causes great bodily harm or death with the intent to, one, intimidate or coerce a civilian population, including committing mass violence in a place of worship or public accommodation, two, influence the policy of a state entity or political subdivision of the state, or three, affect the conduct of a state entity, political subdivision of state, or public accommodation by mass destruction, assassination, kidnapping, or an act of violence enumerated as a serious violent offense in the section above. So, you know, these are pretty specific. This is a specific intent that needs to be proven within the purview of this law. I mean, you can't just look at someone's Facebook post and say, oh, you know, they threatened an act of violence against someone. You know, therefore, we're going to charge them with domestic terrorism. That's not at all the intent of this law.
And so the new parts of this bill, this new bill that's coming in, specifically targets, includes cyber attacks. Am I understanding that correctly? Cyber attacks, and then also increasing communication between law enforcement agencies. Are those the two new parts of this new bill for this legislative session?
Those are new parts of the bill, yes.
Okay. So what can happen to somebody if they're charged with terrorism? Peter, can you explain that?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Let me just actually respond to an earlier comment that the representative made. In the last legislative session, ACLU of New Mexico, which is part of a coalition called New Mexico Safe that weighs in on all criminal justice-related bills, issued a report card on this very bill and actually gave it a D grading. Precisely because of its overbroad definition, because of how it adds criminal enhancements, adds criminal penalties to a criminal code that really is already overpacked with sentencing and crimes that overlap, and unfairly give prosecutors the ability to stack charges in a way that can compel people to plead to charges that maybe even go beyond the actual crime that they've committed, penalties that don't equate with the severity of the crime that they've committed. And so, we as an organization take a stand of general skepticism towards any new criminal enhancements because we have so many laws on the books that already penalize various kinds of behavior. And the more we add to that, the more we overweigh the prosecutorial side of our criminal justice system and give prosecutors this unfair advantage in forcing people to agree to penalties that are not commensurate with the crimes that they've committed. I think one of the important things to point out here, and I think it's behind the question that you just asked, Yasmin, is, what are the implications of a law like this, and can you strictly draw them down to the consequences of prosecution, the sentences, the penalties that are implied, that are included? And in fact, the damage from these kinds of laws takes place long before that. The minute you are suspected of a crime of this nature, you become a target for surveillance. You become a target for intervention by law enforcement into your life in ways that can thoroughly disrupt your own life, to say nothing of just your ability to express yourself as guaranteed under the First Amendment.
Okay.
So, you look at the ways that terrorism laws have been used federally, and what you see is that Black Lives Matter, other protest groups, border protest groups, immigrant rights groups, they have oftentimes been the target of, at the federal level, these kinds of laws. And I might just add, it's kind of curious, but in federal law, we actually do not have a federal statute that makes domestic terrorism a crime. You can be designated as a domestic terrorist threat, or your activity can be, and you can be investigated for that, but you can't actually be charged with a federal crime of domestic terrorism. And we saw that, the former president took great advantage of that and designated BLM a domestic terrorism organization and racial justice protests generally, for example, what was happening in Kenosha.
Okay.
So I'll stop there and let you.
So building on that, would maybe for Representative Hochman Vigil, would white supremacist militias that were involved here in shooting Scott Williams or targeting activist homes, could they be prosecuted under this bill?
Well, I think the better question to ask is, would we be able to prove the intent to prosecute them under this bill? I respect Director Simonson's, general opinion that these laws can be weaponized to try and suppress the movement. But I think that that's an overgeneralized opinion on this, and that, the threat of prosecution generally is you're gonna take issue with that, as opposed to really doing a deep dive into the nuances of what we're trying to charge under this particular crime, which has a very high bar to set And just because someone is suspected of a crime, of course, we're innocent until proven guilty, doesn't mean that we're charging them with one. And again, that's why the definitions within our domestic terrorism definition here in this bill are incredibly important to pay attention to. So I think that if we could prove the intent, this bill could particularly be identified to apply to that set of facts.
All right.
But again, I can't opine on that. I'm not a prosecutor looking to utilize this bill in that way.
We have to go to a quick break, Representative. And if you want to join the conversation about domestic terrorism definitions or private prison contracts in New Mexico, give us a call at 277-5866. You can also tweet to us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
The accordion can do a lot more than just polka. It can croon a sweet serenade, add a bit of whimsy, and coming up, we'll hear the sultry, sensual side of the accordion. I'm Fred Child. Join me for the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This week in This American Life, Blake's friend Camille sent him an old photograph of herself. In it, she's a little kid on vacation with her family in Canada.
And then I glanced back at the picture, and I saw my grandma walking through behind her.
Blake and Camille grew up in different states. Camille didn't know him at that age or his grandma. Coincidences, do they mean anything this week?
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Yasmin Khan. This morning, we are talking about two House bills on domestic terrorism definitions and private prison contracts. Next up, we will take a look at House Bill 40, but right now we are continuing our conversation with House Bill 70. Have you or your community been impacted by private prisons? Give us a call at 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. I'd like to welcome Justin Allen, an activist with Millions for Prisoners who was formerly incarcerated. Justin, where does your organization stand with this bill, and what concerns do you have?
Millions for Prisoners does not support this bill. None of the insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol are concerned with being defined a terrorist. This bill will not deter white supremacy. Even with the best intention, expanding the criminal punishment system is a corporate agenda that relies on the commodification of black and brown bodies for profit. The war on drugs and 9/11 has taught us how mandatory minimums, criminal enhancements, and terrorism definitions have had a disproportionate impact on people of color, queer, and transgender people. The word terrorism has been used to justify family separation, children in cages, and violence against Muslim Americans. Therefore, in order for this bill to target the violence that it was intended to, it should be called white supremacist definitions instead. White supremacy has shaped the law and economy, which is why protesters who attempted to remove the Oñate statue here in Albuquerque are more likely to be impacted by a bill like this under the civil disorder definition than the white supremacist New Mexico Civil Guardsman Stephen Ray Baca, who shot a protester. Albuquerque Police Department refers to New Mexico Civil Guards as armed friendlies. Meanwhile, this bill defines possessing a terroristic weapon and making a terroristic threat, which could mean anything depending on police discretion. We have also witnessed how this sort of legislation has impacted water protectors at Standing Rock. Instead of supporting what this bill says it's going to do, we must consider what it actually does. In the same way legislation born from the war on drugs has disproportionately impacted people of color, we can expect the same if this bill is passed. Unfortunately, it is likely this bill will get passed considering how fear-mongering was used after 9/11 to promote similar legislation. Until our legislators start addressing white supremacist violence specifically, we will continue to see reform agendas like this bill that reproduce the criminalization of people of color and the expansion of the prison industrial complex.
So from that, Representative, how can we ensure that this bill won't be used to disproportionately target communities of color or civil rights groups here in New Mexico?
So, I mean, I would... I I thank the caller for that particular perspective and the Millions for Prisoners organization, especially their organizer, Swenda Guerrero, who I've known for quite some time. And I very much appreciate their agenda. And, you know, everything that he said is absolutely true. And we have to be very careful about the commodification of, you know, people of color and the expansion of the prison industrial complex. But I'd like to just start by saying, you know, our laws are a reflection of our values as a society, and I don't think we can find a single person who can tell us that politically motivated violence is okay, especially given the wake of what we've seen in the last month or so with the storming of the Capitol and, you know, the actions of our former president. So that's not, it's certainly not my intent. I do think that with a law such as this one, we are making a statement to those. I also take action that take issue with the fact that white supremacy would not be addressed under this bill. It absolutely would be addressed under the purview of this bill. And that would be the intent. Now, I think the concern that it might be that the discretion of law enforcement might come into play as to who would be charged under the purview of this bill and who would not. And that is certainly something to consider. But again, that's why I would bring it back to the definitions that and the intent requirements that we include. I continue to be interested in working with the New Mexico Safe Coalition to see if we can come to some sort of compromise with regards to this bill, because I believe that we all stand in solidarity and that we have to do something to address politically motivated crime, especially if it's motivated by, violence and white supremacy and with an intent to hurt our communities of color. So, we might be in an impasse. We may not. But at the end of the day, I think we're both trying to fight the same things, maybe just in different ways.
Peter, do you have any thoughts on Justin's comments or Representative Hochman Vigo's response?
Well, yeah, definitely. I appreciate Justin's contributions there, and he covered some issues that I think I missed that are critical to bring up. And, you know, I think I share the representative's general concern that I think is motivating this legislation, that we do have groups in this country that are now intent on trying to thwart the interests of our democracy, thwart the proper functioning of our democracy. What we have not seen is indications that our government here in the state or otherwise doesn't have the tools necessary to actually investigate and prosecute people that present that threat. We already see that, you know, in the case of the Capitol building insurrection, that we've got, literally hundreds of prosecutions now taking place for the people that committed those acts. You know, whether the criminal violence is politically motivated or not, it's still a crime. And so whether the intent is political or not, right now we have laws on the books that allow those crimes to be investigated and prosecuted. And, you know, the discretionary issue, I think, is an interesting one. And we here in New Mexico have some experience with it. Even precisely as it concerns militia groups. It wasn't all that long ago. In fact, it was 2 years ago that we had a militia group on our southern border that was taking hostage immigrant families that were coming across the border in pursuit of a better life. And they were actually posting their illegal activity online on their Facebook site. Clear violations of our state statutes against kidnapping and hostage and hostage taking. And yet our authorities made no effort to stop their activity, much less to criminally prosecute those individuals. It was only after we raised a stink about it in the news for several weeks that eventually the FBI actually intervened. So, you know, here you actually have a situation where I think the very kind of group that this law is intended to try and target when they commit illegal acts, our state authorities are making decisions about where and where not to use their law enforcement resources. And likewise, I think we could expect that to see that in the future. And you can only imagine that we have a government in office, in power here in the state that has very different political views, maybe aligned with those of our previous presidential administration, and has these kinds of tools at its disposal. Who will actually be the target of these kinds of laws? And will these laws actually be used for strictly impartial purposes, or will they be used for political purposes, just in the same way that our federal Department of Justice was viewing its own mission under the Trump administration.
So Peter, what would the ACLU, what specific parts of the bill would need to change to address the concerns of the ACLU?
Well, there's no need for this law. It's entirely redundant. So we would urge law enforcement to use the laws that it has under its own under its existing authority to address any sort of activity that you identify as being terrorism related. And again, I think we should be asking the Attorney General, the state, the governor, our political leaders who support this legislation, what have they been, what criminal acts, what terrorist acts have they been unable to investigate and prosecute in our history that this law would now allow them to do? Where have they been compromised? Mm-hmm. And we don't have any evidence that they've been barred or in any way undermined by the lack of laws like this.
Yes, Representative Hochman-Vico, do you want to respond? I know you do have to jump off this call in a bit, too.
I do have to jump off. I mean, I appreciate Dr. Simonson's, you know, again, his perspective on this, but, you know, I think it's important to kind of keep in mind the motivations of the ACLU and groups that we represent in that. You know, they're not going to support any law that's going to increase penalties or create new penalties, because that just goes against the very philosophy of what their organization, you know, is here to protect against. And again, I've worked for that organization, and I believe in their mission very much, but it's their job to oppose laws like this. But at the same time that he's saying there's no need for this law, a law that creates an entirely new standard and a more nuanced standard that would, you know, require specific intent be proven, he's saying, well, there's no need for a law. Let's use laws that, in the same breath, he's also said, have been used against, you know, communities of color. You know, laws that have a more generalized approach and can be used in a more generalized way. So, you know, it's kind of like an interesting damned if we do, damned if we don't. There's no need for this law. So we need to use other laws that, you know, Director Simonson is also saying can be, you know, are being weaponized and shouldn't be used against specific communities. So I would just ask the ACLU to kind of hone that approach and, you know, have a more direct message. So with that, I have to jump off. Thank you very much for the very interesting conversation. I appreciate what you guys are doing, and have a good day.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for being with us. And listeners, as a reminder, you can look up these bills that the legislature is considering on the New Mexico Legislature website at nmlegis.gov. And today we're examining House Bill 70 and House Bill 40, both of which you can find at that site. And we have links to them on KUNM.org as well. And switching gears, I would like to welcome Representative Karen Bash, co-sponsor of House Bill 40, which aims to eliminate private prison contracts in New Mexico. Representative Bash, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And Representative, can you tell us how this bill came about and why it's important? Why are contracts the focus of this bill?
Thank you. I think several people kind of came up with the same idea at the same time and decided to work together on the Private Detention Facility Moratorium Act, House Bill 40. And one of the reasons that we came up with it is that incarceration is a government function that involves the use of coercive police powers and to deprive individuals of their liberty. And this is not an activity that should be relegated to the private sector, because in the private sector, there are clear profit motives and incentives to cut costs both in labor compensation and rehab programs. And it also encourages growth in the number of people incarcerated, and depriving their depriving people of their liberty is a sovereign endeavor and should not be undertaken as a money-making adventure. And New Mexico has one of the highest rates of private prison detainees in the country, and this country has one of the highest rates of incarceration in the world. And we believe that the state is better equipped to handle the prisons.
So contracts are the focus of this bill, which is similar to President Biden's executive order that he signed the other day to eliminate private prison contracts with the Justice Department. Why are contracts the focus of this bill, and what is their significance?
Well, contracts are the focus of the bill because the state has a contract with private prisons already. And rather than breaking those contracts, what we are seeking to do is to prevent the renewal of the contract at their expiration date. And that's the way to get out of the contracts, is to let them expire.
And so how does this state bill compare with President Biden's federal order that he signed on January 26th?
Well, President Biden's bill would affect federal prisons, and this bill addresses state facilities.
Okay. Peter, where does the ACLU stand with this bill?
Well, first of all, let me thank Representative Nash for carrying this really important piece of legislation. It's a long time in coming that the state has needed to come to grips with its addiction to privately managed incarceration facilities. We have by far and away the largest percentage of our inmates in the state. Representative Bash, held in privately managed facilities. You know, we have a variety of what we've seen over the years, a variety of problems in our private prison facilities, both in jails and also in immigrant detention facilities. We see that, you know, there are higher rates of abuse, higher rates of threats to the staff that work there, safety problems. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that because these facilities claim to be privately managed, even though they function as quasi-governmental entities, because they are actually taking over a governmental function, they claim the right to not have to respond to our public records laws. And so it makes them virtually opaque insofar as the public's ability to understand what's happening with people who are housed in these facilities. And we confront this all the time, where we receive complaints from these facilities from inmates who are being denied proper medical care. They're subject to poor hygiene, poor sanitation. They aren't being protected against the spread of COVID. And simply to find out what's going on inside of those facilities, you know, our only mechanism is to use public records laws under our state statutes. And they refuse to respond to them because they claim that they're private facilities. And so, you know, that alone creates this huge barrier to ensure that people are, in fact, being treated properly and given the due their needs are being met by way of medical care and food and other kinds of things. Mm. So, you know, we would love to see the state wean itself off of this private prison complex and move to having government-run facilities again, where these facilities don't need to devote a portion of their revenue to shareholder profits. I mean, that mm-hmm. is, at the end of the day, the basic problem, right? If you have a government-run facility, the resources go to care for the people who are being held in custody. In the case of a privately managed facility, part of that revenue has to go to shareholders. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just before we have to go to break, Justin, does Millions for Prisoners support this bill?
Yes, we support this bill. This is something that we've discussed prior to this bill being introduced, and we're in full support. There's been a problem with Corizon. We know how the medical provider is contracted, and there's a lot of medical neglect and abuse issues that happen within the private facilities. So, yeah, we're in full support of this bill to end the private detention.
Excellent. And we do have to go to a quick break again. If you want to join the conversation about domestic terrorism or private prison contracts in New Mexico, give us a call at 277-5866. You can also tweet to us with the hashtag Let's Talk NM. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
Brett Inguist grew up on the powwow trail. Now the Canadian dancer and musician is blending traditional powwow beats with hip-hop and other contemporary rhythms, making a sound all his own. He's a Juno and Indigenous Music Award nominee and is our January Music Maker. Tune in to hear Brett Inguist on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Someone you know mentioned suicide? Here's 18 seconds on what to do.
Ask that person what they mean, have them explain what's going on with them in their life, you know, with real curiosity before trying to convince them of anything, you know, whether or not to do that. And I also will say, like, I'm not going to do this perfectly, so just bear with me. I'm just do my best to be with you because I love you. Just hang in here with me.
More on confronting suicide on the next Peace Talks Radio, Friday morning, 8 to 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Yasmin Khan. We've heard this hour some debate over two House bills concerning domestic terrorism and private prison contracts. Do you think New Mexico needs new domestic terrorism legislation? Have you been impacted by the private prison industry? Give us a call, 277-5866. And I'd like to reintroduce our guest, Peter Simonson, Executive Director of the ACLU, Justin Allen with Millions for Prisoners, Representative Karen Bash, co-sponsor of House Bill 40, aimed at eliminating private prison contracts. Now, Representative Bash, how will this bill impact communities in New Mexico that rely on private prison jobs?
Yes, one of the arguments for private prisons is that it provides employment for the community. However, studies have shown that rates of unemployment are not lower in communities that have private prisons than they are surrounding communities that don't. And sometimes their rates are higher, actually. As far as I'm concerned, the employees of private prisons should be moved over to public prisons, and where they are likely to get higher salaries and union benefits. That is not the case in private prisons because of the profit motive. Salaries are low, turnover is high, and recidivism is higher in private prisons than in publicly run prisons. And part of that reason is that because of the low staffing ratios, private prisons are more dangerous. There are more incidents of violence, and people should be employed in state prisons as well as private prisons, and would be better off.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bash. We do have a caller, Dr. Lane Leckman. Dr. Leckman, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm just calling in to say that I have been in these private prisons numerous times doing psychiatric evaluations on people who are seeking asylum in the United States, all of whom are people who are leaving desperate, dangerous situations in their countries of origin and have traveled thousands of miles to get to our country to seek safety. And in almost every case, the care that I witnessed being given was not good. It was unfortunate, and several people who were fairly sick did not get the care that they needed, even though I tried to intervene with their medical system. on numerous occasions. And I remember one man in particular whose medical records I was able to obtain up to a certain point, who had indications from his lab tests that he had cancer, was eventually deported after being in private prisons in New Mexico and in Texas for several years. He was deported, and when he got back to the country in Africa that he came from, they actually finally operated on him for the cancer, although he's just recently been sentenced to death by a court that tried him there. And so it's a serious situation, a problem, and not only do we need to make different immigration rules, but we also need to make sure we don't use private prisons to incarcerate people.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Luckman, for your message and in talking about your experience. Justin, you know, this bill does not aim to necessarily close or reform prisons. So what does ending of these contracts ultimately mean for the daily lives of prisoners or asylum seekers in detention?
You asked what the ending of the contracts mean?
Yeah. What would it mean for just the lived reality for people that are in these detention centers and these prisons?
Well, fortunately, the contracts won't be renewed, and the government will have to find alternatives to housing that are more that are healthier and more rehabilitative than what we're seeing right now. Just from what I've seen, the difference in private detention versus state facilities, the medical care is what I'm concerned with. I mean, it's a completely different, a different type of medical care and treatment you get in the state facilities versus private facilities. Okay. What it would mean, ending these contracts is, reinvesting in humanity, reinvesting in, and you know, seeking alternatives to incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think from what I saw from a little bit of research I did is in 2018, private prisons made almost $2 billion in profits in the United States federally. Peter or Justin, do you have any, or Representative Bash, do you have any numbers on the revenues from private prisons are bringing in New Mexico?
I don't have any totals on the number, on the amount of money that private prisons are bringing in. However, some people are afraid that if we end private prison contracts, that it's going to cost the state more. However, according to the Legislative Finance Committee data, for a comparable level of care or even a better level of care, it's actually going to cost the state $26 million a year less.
Or are you going to switch?
And the cost savings was supposed to be 20% to 30% back when Governor Johnson went to private prisons, but that hasn't proven to be the case.
Yes. Oh, okay. Thank you, Representative Bash. And we do have Cheryl from Albuquerque who does have a question about these finances. Cheryl, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I want to know a little more specifically where the heck do these profits come from that the prisoners can't pay. They're not going to pay for that horrible incarceration. Where does the money originally come from anyway? I assume it's from the state. It's from our tax money. So these guys are making a profit off of our state money. I mean, that's a question. I just want more clarification on the whole money thing. And I also want to say I appreciate so much this new bill, and I sure hope it passes.
tell me if that's what the chances are that we're going to get this passed, because this privatization of the prison system has been horrible for years. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Representative, can you take that question from Cheryl?
Yes, I sure can. She is right that the money comes from our taxes. And one of the problems with the private prisons is that they have a requirement of so many beds being filled in their facilities. So whether or not there are prisoners in those beds, the state is paying for them. And there is an incentive, because of the quota requirements, there's an incentive for private prisons to incarcerate more people and for the state to incarcerate more people to fill those beds.
Boy, it's abominable. It's a terrible system.
Yes.
Yeah, the private. I mean, if the state's going to pay for a private enterprise, then they should set me up and all my neighbors and poor people, they should set us up in businesses that make sense, right? Instead of
It would actually cost the state less to send each prisoner to college than it costs to incarcerate them.
And that's the fundamental problem anyway. People don't have options. So that would give them options. Let's do that.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bash. I do want to introduce Margaret Brown Vega to the show. Margaret is a volunteer with Advocate Visitors with Immigrants in Detention. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So President Biden's bill does not include ending contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which detains thousands of asylum seekers and undocumented immigrants around the country. The U.S. detains more immigrants than any other country, according to the National Immigration Forum. So why is it important that this bill in New Mexico includes contracts that are working with detention centers that are detaining immigrants and asylum seekers?
Sure. That's a great question. I mean, I think we can look at what other states have done. For example, California, they had a private prison ban, but it actually, for example, didn't really focus on Department of Corrections in the state of California. You could look at a place like Illinois, who had a similar kind of law, but focused a little bit more on these other kinds of facilities. So if we agree that private prisons, whatever kind of facility these private prison contractors operate, are poorly run, are understaffed, have poor conditions, cut corners, all of those things, then it doesn't really matter who they detain, right? The facility is going to be a problem. So the contracts should be the focus. And this is what HB 40 tries to do, is kind of look at the contracts regardless of the type of facility and regardless who's in custody. So it includes Department of Corrections in New Mexico, and it also includes facilities that hold people in federal custody. So that's U.S. Marshals and also ICE custody. And it has to be that way. Otherwise, what we're going to end up doing is setting up a situation where they can continue to thrive in this state. They'll just find different kinds of people to incarcerate for profit.
So House Bill 40, even though it's a state bill, it would include federal detention centers, ending contracts with federal detention centers in New Mexico?
It treats private incarceration, it recognizes it as a business and basically seeks to end that activity here in New Mexico. Yeah. So it really doesn't matter in what kind of facility it is, that there cannot be the operation or management of any kind of facility by a private contractor.
Mm. And so Representative Bash, why was it important to include ending private prison private contracts with immigrant detention centers in this state bill, if even President Biden didn't even include that in the federal bill?
Well, in some of our detention centers, there's a combination of immigration detention and criminal detention. And so you don't want to close half of a facility or in the contracts on half of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
And the detention centers for immigration are really despicable in terms of how they're run, medical attention, the quality of food that is given, the attention that people receive in terms of legal services, and it's just a bad situation.
Okay. Margaret, beyond this bill, what else needs to be done in New Mexico to support immigrants and asylum seekers in detention?
Sure. That's a great question. You know, I just saw an article, again, saying that at the federal level, Biden is still considering not relying on private prisons for immigration and customs enforcement. And I think we need to continue pushing for that. You know, I'm an immigration advocate, and so I'm also, I'll say, an abolitionist. We really don't need immigration detention. That can completely go away. You know, in the state of New Mexico, we went very quickly from having one dedicated facility that was opened in 2008, the Otero County Processing Center, to a couple of years ago, Cibola opening up to hold people, to Torrance opening up. And so I think, you know, we need to do our duty in the state to make sure that we're not providing spaces that can potentially be used to house people, whether it's in immigration detention or whether it's in other forms of detention, especially if they're managed by private contractors. I think it's surprising to know that most immigration detention in the United States nationally is privately managed. That has been a huge boom for the private prison contractors at a time when mass incarceration was starting to decline, when we were starting to imprison fewer and fewer people. So
I think
mass incarceration is a complex patchwork. These companies will always look to find, again, different kinds of people to house because that's how they make their money. And so, you know, as a state most reliant on these contractors, we need to get rid of them from the state of New Mexico.
And does the state have power to eliminate immigration detention completely?
No, that's a federal issue. That's a federal issue. However, we can say that in New Mexico, we're not going to allow these private contractors, right, to operate facilities of this nature here in the state.
Okay. And Peter, what does the ACLU prioritize in terms of moving forward with prison reform and prisoner rights in New Mexico? We've got about 1 minute left here.
Well, we are working as it concerns generally criminal legal justice reform issues. We're working together with the New Mexico Safe Coalition, which is a coalition of a couple dozen different organizations around the state that are all committed to seeing our criminal legal system change from a hyper punitive system that fragments families, makes our communities less safer, to a system that actually gives people the ability to reconstruct their lives and become contributing members of society. That, you know, we've got various pieces of legislation, including probation and parole reform, reducing, if not eliminating, many of the fees and fines that are associated with criminal penalties. They can go to the New Mexico Safe website if folks have any further interest in those pieces of legislation.
Excellent. Thank you so much. There is so much to talk about with these bills and everything else in the legislature. But that's all the time we have for today. Many thanks to our guest, Peter Simonson, Representatives Diane Huckman-Vigil and Karen Bash, Justin Allen, and Margaret Brown-Vega. And thank you to everyone who called or sent comments. If you missed part of today's show or want to share it with friends, find the show page on KUNM.org or just subscribe to our podcast. Just search Let's Talk New Mexico on your podcast app. Thank you, as always, to our engineer, Roman Garcia. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show. Megan Kamrick screened our calls. And Ty Bannerman is our producer. I'm Yasmin Khan. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.